Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As always, we appreciate you all taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with the esteemed cohort that's joining us live, if you're so inclined, if you scroll to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find a link to the chat room. And we already have Paul and Mr. Cal there athwart the quarterdeck. They'll be glad to bring you on board. And that's the perfect place if during the course of the show you have some observations you'd like to share, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guest at some course during the program. We will be monitoring it during the entire time, and we'll be glad to go ahead and grab your ideas and fold it right into the conversation. And also, if you've got a busy life and you've got to run off and take care of some business and you want to see what you missed, or if you haven't had a chance already to subscribe to the free podcast so Midrats is ready for you and your commute at your convenience, you can do that at any time at iTunes, Spreaker, or any of those podcast aggregators you may use. And on to today's show, we're going to have a great hour today talking about some big pixel items. For regular listeners of Midrats here and of my co-host and I's various writings here and there, it should seem normal because any cursory glance at a map will tell you that the United States is a maritime nation. And our history also shows that our economic power and our national security is intimately linked to the sea. And those that are maritime professionals, we feel that that's normal. But in some ways, we're the fish, and that's the water we swim in. We don't realize it. But it's not that common as you would think among the general population. And to order to make sure that our nation has that security and our economic and our military requirements, each generation, I think, has to sometimes relearn it or to emphasize it because they did learn it and they grow what previous generations have built. And, you know, here we are coming up on 2022. There are a lot of domestic distractions and competing priorities both inside and outside the national security arena. And as other nations, like the People's Republic of China, decide that they kind of like that gig that we've had as Command of the Seas, and they want to come up and get their slice of it. The topic of maritime power, both its military and civilian components, has really started to reach a point that we could bring it above the ambient noise in the day-to-day news cycle. And this fall, there's been a new voice that's going to join in this conversation and hope bring that message and help shape the conversation in a way that's productive to our nation. And that the Navy League of the United States, that most people are familiar with, they have set up a new Center for Maritime Strategy. And our guest for the full hour to discuss it, the message it'll bring to the conversation, and its role is the inaugural dean of the Center for Maritime Strategy, Admiral Jamie Fogo, U.S. Navy retired. Admiral Fogo, welcome to Midrats.
Oh, and Eagle One, thanks very much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners today.
And it's a pleasure having you on board, especially now that you're just setting things up. First of all, you know, congratulations for being the inaugural dean, because I know with your very long career in the Navy that more often than not, you're stepping into a new job and a responsibility that's been around in many cases longer than you have, and there's established procedures, personalities, habits, and infrastructures. And now and then, when life gives you an opportunity to set up in a new place, it gives you an opportunity to use your background and experience to do your best to form that up and a way to your going. And I guess just to kick things off, if you could, describe for a bit the few months that y'all have been up and running, how y'all have kind of established the center right now, and what are some things y'all going to be doing in the new year to get hopefully most of your players in place and getting ready to really start to move up in the conversation.
Hey, Sal, thanks very much for the opportunity to talk about the center. And I just finished my third week on the job. So I, just by way of background, retired from the United States Navy last September after almost 40 years of service. So I'm a submariner. Most people that I affiliate with know that. I spent about 12 years of my life at sea and at sea billets or underwater. I did about the same amount of time in Washington, D.C. in a variety of jobs, mostly in the Pentagon, on all the staffs, the Navy staff, the Joint Staff, and even the Office of the Secretary of Defense's staff. And then I had one quick fellowship up at Georgetown University, which was phenomenal, and I did almost 2 years over at Naval Reactors as the executive assistant to Admiral Skip Bowman. So that gave me a perspective that you don't get when you go in there and just study for the engineer's exam or attend the prospective commanding officer's course. And that's a phenomenal institution that has really taken the Navy a long way from, just plain steam to nuclear propulsion, and a huge benefit for us in the world of carriers and submarines. And then I did about an equivalent amount of time, 10-12 years overseas. And I took command of USS Oklahoma City back in 1998, had her for 3 years, deployed three times. That was my first command, and I had the privilege and the honor of commanding eight more times after that, overseas in billets that were U.S. billets and also NATO billets. So I'm a big fan of partnerships and alliance. And my last job is Commander Naval Forces Europe, Commander Naval Forces Africa, and Commander Allied Joint Force Command for all of NATO's southern flank, two different headquarters, three different jobs. I call it the trifecta. Was by far the best and most challenging assignment I ever had. It's one of those jobs where you love getting up in the morning, you love going to work, you love working with the people, not just Americans, but all of our allies and partners. 30 NATO allies and a total of 41 partners that try to deal with problems all across the European continent, the African continent, and all the way into the Middle East. And we had a mission in the Middle East and Iraq that I stood up the NATO training mission for training Iraqi troops so that American troops wouldn't have to go in and deal with ISIS again. So, that by way of background, I think, gives me an opportunity to give back some of my experience and my skill sets that I've learned over these 40 years to the Navy League and to the new Center for Maritime Strategy. And when I was approached by the Navy League, it was kind of a surprise. They'd done a study, and they asked me to come in and read the study on the need for a Center for Maritime Strategy. I absolutely loved it. And I told the former MCPON, MCPON 13, Mike Stevens, that this was a great idea. And I asked him how I could help. And did he need, any assistance in trying to find people for the center? He said, yeah, actually I do. And, we're looking for somebody to head up the center as the director or the dean. And we all kind of, coalesced around the term dean because this is really a think tank. And I said, okay, well, I'll start looking around. He goes, well, actually, we were thinking about a retired four-star. And I said, really? Not too many of those out there. And he said, well, we'd like you to consider it. So we had a long conversation over the course of about 4 to 6 weeks and finally came to an agreement that, I would take this job. And it's been, all ahead flank cavitate ever since. And so, I arrived at the center It really is a startup, kind of like Silicon Valley, but, you know, profit is not our motive. Our motive is to be advocates for all things in the maritime domain. And you guys hit on it when we started out here. You know, 90% of our commerce goes by the sea. You know, more than 95% of our communications are carried by critical undersea infrastructure. You know, this is something that Mahan never conceived of when he coined the phrase sea lines of communication. Probably the most important sea line of communication are those cables that span the globe and carry not only national security information, but, you know, all of our market economy information. And, you know, so I was delighted to take this thing on and represent all of our maritime interests. And that's more than just the United States Navy. And that is the United States Navy, our best joint partner, the United States Marine Corps, the United States Coast Guard. And, you know, just last week, we had Commandant Carl Schultz from the Coast Guard in for a Navy League breakfast. And I'd love to invite you guys down for one of these events. They're absolutely fantastic. And I think this was Commandant Schultz's fourth Navy League event in the last few months. I mean, he's a huge proponent of what we try to do. And, you know, I introduced him at the breakfast, and I told him, you know, forgive me for saying this, but, you know, the Commandant was a service chief and a member of the Joint Chiefs, and I was a component commander in Europe. We're both four stars, but he was senior to me in lineal number and in position, but I called him my battle buddy. And the reason for that is because he did so much to help me in Africa, particularly in West Africa, in the Gulf of Guinea, in the fight against illegal trafficking of all things, narcotics, humans, and weapons, and the nexus between illegal trafficking and terrorism. And so we are, in the center, a great proponent of the United States Coast Guard. The U.S. Merchant Marine, you know, that's a service that just has incredible value for this island nation of the United States of America, whose commerce, 90% of whose commerce goes by the sea. And we've allowed that service to atrophy over time, not because the service wants to, but because of resources and funding. And so we are going to advocate for the Merchant Marine, and I look forward to working with a number of different people, Busby, a fellow submariner friend, Chip Janikin. Both of those guys were heads of the Maritime Administration, and then a very capable member of the Navy League, John Kaskins, who's been dabbling in the Merchant Marine and policy issues for decades. And we are so fortunate to have John on board the team at the Navy League to help out and help advocate for the Merchant Marine. I was just up in New York City 2 weeks ago, Friday night, for an event called the Admiral of the Ocean Seas Award. And it was a well-attended event. There were hundreds of people there. And this event was to celebrate the Maritime Administration, the Merchant Marine, our ability to lift around the world. And several awards were given out to very senior people who had contributed to that for decades. And I was delighted to see General Jackie Van Obost, who had served on the Joint Staff when I was Director of the Navy Staff. She's now the head of TRANSCOM. My former PAO, John Perkins, one of the best PAOs in the business, left Europe when I retired, and he is now working for General Van Obost, and she's very interested in strategic communications to get the word out to people that, you know, sea lift and airlift is really important, and we're all about that as well. And, you know, Admiral Mike Wetlaufer was there. Mike is the commander of Military Sealift Command. He's an aviator nuke. He's a friend of mine. I know him, and, you know, we chat all the time about how important our Military Sealift Command is, our auxiliary ships are. I live and died by that when I was in Europe. You know, my favorite ship in the United States Navy is the USS Mount Whitney. You know, I was a one-star, three-star, four-star over there. I was Sixth Fleet Commander. She was my command ship. I love that ship. And Military Sealift Command has left her in place for, you know, from the time I got there as Sixth Fleet, 2014 to present. And they've done service life extension programs on her incrementally over time in foreign shipyards home mechanical, electrical, IT. They've done a marvelous job. And I think that goes unnoticed and should be rewarded with praise because, you know, Mount Whitney's a fantastic platform. We only have a couple like at Blue Ridge in the Pacific, Mount Whitney in Africa and Europe. And you can do anything from that ship. I actually fought a small war from that ship in the Libya campaign in Joint Task Force Odyssey Dawn back in 2011. So MSC is on my radar target signals list as an organization that punches way above its weight class and could certainly use our help and advocacy. And finally, you don't get there with a powerful Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Merchant Marine, and Military Sealift Command without an amazing industrial base and our shipbuilders. And so we are going to advocate for, you know, more in the industrial base. I think it's clear to everybody that, you know, enough facilities, we don't have enough docks, we're not building enough ships. And I firmly believe that, you know, we can help in our part of the Center for Maritime Strategy in convincing all of the players who have a hand on budget and resources for this great nation to do more. And, you know, one of the things I think, which sometimes is heresy in the Pentagon, is there's a lot of money out there in the defense budget. You know, last time I checked, $744 billion. You know, and some people say, well, we've got to have more. Well, I say it's how you allocate those resources. So I think it's time to have a conversation about the one-third, one-third, one-third paradigm. And perhaps there could be a little bit more given to the maritime domain and specifically the United States Navy and our floating partners in the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard and the Merchant Marine. So that's kind of, you know, how we're thinking about the center as we stand it up. And I think it's a perfect time for us to do this. I mean, if you look at a number of indicators, you know, we're in the throes of probably the most challenging great power competition of all times. I don't have to tell you guys or your listeners this, but, you know, back during the Cold War, I hesitate to say it was easy because I fought the Third Battle of the Atlantic and it was hard. But, you know, we had one big foe, and that was the Soviet Union. And she had her satellites, and we had our alliances. Nowadays, there's five adversaries out there spelled out in the National Defense Strategy. So China, new player on the block. Russia, of course, hasn't gone away. And I have maintained my entire career that Russia is dangerous. It's a lot of people think she's in decline. Well, just look at what's happened in Syria. Look at what's happened in the high north. Look at what happened in Libya. And look what's going on right now in the Ukraine. So Russia is there to stay, and it's going to continue to be a challenge for us. Iran, North Korea, and violent extremist organizations. So during this trifecta, when I was in Europe, I saw four out of five of those adversaries. Thank goodness I didn't have to deal with Kim Jong-un. But the Iranians were a threat. It got really dicey during the killing of Soleimani, General Soleimani, especially with a NATO mission in Baghdad, Tajin, Iraq, in Iraq. And the Iranians have always been a reason for our strong posture overseas for missile defense because they get a lot of them. And should deterrence fail, then we want to make sure that we knock those missiles out of the sky before they hit any kind of a U.S. facility or, you know, damage any of our partners and allies. I talked about the decline of the industrial base and the labor to support it, and I think we need a shot of adrenaline and resources to bring that back up to speed. And generally speaking, it's a perfect time now for the center because, you know, globalization is at the focal point of all of our economies, and a lot of that, as I said and you said, you know, transits by the seas. Nowadays, we deal with the ubiquity of the internet and social media, and that leads to problems for us in two new domains, cyber and space. Now, I'm an old warrior, started out, graduated from the academy in 1981. So cyber and space was new to me when it came on, and, you know, about 10 years ago, it took NATO a little while to embrace those domains, but it is clearly a threat. When you look at things like the recent Russia hackathon, the interference with our elections, and and Colonial Pipeline and the damage that did to commerce here on the East Coast of the United States. Platforms, weapon systems, sensors, networks are getting more difficult, and they've got to be protected. And that is a challenge nowadays that permeates not just the land and the air domain, but also the maritime domain. And then finally, I think you can see from the current political environment, it's very difficult to achieve consensus on Capitol Hill. And so, part of what we want to do at the center is to create a center of excellence, a center of expertise. And I'll talk to you in a minute about where we intend to get that expertise because, I'm hiring. I'm going through my first hiring cycle right now. And, we want to build consensus in favor of the maritime with our congressional leadership and congressional staffers, the authorizers and the appropriators and the strategists. And we want to make it clear to them, those who may not have naval experience, that, there is a value in a very strong United States Navy and all the other services that make up the maritime domain. So, we've got our work cut out for us, and I think that it's going to be exciting. It's going to be challenging, and I'm really looking forward to 2022 because I think as we roll over into this new year, we're going to be accelerating. This train's left the station, and it's moving fast. And back to you guys for any follow-ups.
Yeah, one of the institutions you've kind of cited as sort of a model for where you're going with this is the Mitchell Institute for the Air Force and aerospace. Can you talk a little bit about what you see in their model that what you'd like to follow at the, if any of it, at the Center for Maritime Strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I got a lot of respect for the Mitchell Institute, and there's really two officers that have kind of spearheaded this. And like the Navy League, the Air Force has a counterpart in the Air Force Association. That's headed by Lieutenant General Orville Wright, great call sign. And the gentleman and retired three-star that is heading the Mitchell Institute and has done just a fantastic job is Lieutenant General Dave Deptula. General Deptula and I first met back in 1994. So my first Pentagon assignment was on this very cool but rather strange cell called the Navy Cell for the Commission on Roles and Missions of the Armed Forces. And so we were all working for it was a very interesting crowd of folks. There were some staff officers, including myself, Steve Davis, God bless him, passed away from thyroid cancer a few years ago. He's a great surface warrior, and we remained friends through the command tour, and then ultimately I was very, very sorry when we lost Steve. And Tony Wentz, who later retired as Navy IG, was a three-star. We were all lieutenant commanders and commanders back then. Commander Jake Shuford, who, finally commanded the Naval War College. Jake was a commander when he came in. He made captain. And down the hall, affiliated with us, was Captain Joe Sestak. And we all worked for Vice Admiral Phil Durr, the N-35. And that's when I found my niche. I loved being in strategy and policy, and it was an exciting time. And once a week, Admiral Durr would call us in, and we would go down and brief Borda as CNO, because Admiral Borda was all about, success for the Navy and the Commission on Roles and Missions of the Armed Forces. So he put together this group because he believed it was that important to articulate the value of the Navy for the commission headed by John White. He was later up at Harvard University. He came from Kodak, I believe, and a very successful businessman. And then that commission report was going to be passed on to Congress. The whole purpose for the thing was to eliminate duplication and replication of resources within all of the services. So, they had something like 17 issues, typical stuff for a commission. It was, why do we have five air forces? Why do we have the U.S. Air Force, the Navy Air Arm, the Marine Air Arm, the Coast Guard, and, anybody else out there that was flying machines around? The Army has you know, lots of helicopters. I think they had more helicopters than the Navy. And, of course, each one of those services has a need for a specific type of platform. You know, the Army, look at the A-10. It's been around for a very long time. The Air Force has tried to cancel that program, and the Army needs it for close air support. It's just a wonderful platform. It's done yeoman service in places like Iraq and Afghanistan for our troops on the ground. Well, Colonel Datula was, he was one of the Air Force reps on the commission, inside the commission headquarters at the time. And I recognized his brilliance, you know, at that point in my career as a lieutenant commander. The guy is super sharp. He understands, you know, all aspects of the Air Force, not just the pointy nose of a fighter pilot. I think he was an F-15 guy, but, you know, also the importance of, you know, military airlift command and also space. And so he articulated very well for General McPeak, who was their service chief at the time, and we tried to emulate that as best we could in the commission. So that was my first introduction to him, and I followed him throughout the rest of his career through retirement. And here he is now, a few years into the Billy Mitchell Center, and they've done quite well. It's a case study that, you know, at Harvard University, for a startup, they'd say that startup was really successful. So we want to emulate that, and we want to be like the Billy Mitchell Center for the maritime services. So like I said, I'll see General Datula at the end of the month. He's been very forthright and supportive of this initiative. He's talked to Mike Stevens. You know, back in the day, as I told you a couple of months ago, when the Navy League came up with a prospectus or a study for our program, and, you know, there was no service rivalry there. He said, hey, I think Mike quartered him as saying, it's about time the United States Navy needs something like this. So, you know, I'm excited to share his lessons learned and, you know, how they've actually done this when we get together in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I kind of grinned when you mentioned General Datula, and I'll come around to him here at the end of my question, because one thing that my co-host and I we've both written about through the years, and we've had guests on here, we've talked about on a regular basis, where the conversation about not just our Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, but that little part of budget priorities, what we're doing, what we aren't doing, is that there seemed to be that voice that was missing or would come near the line of saying something or making a point, but for a variety of reasons we might touch on later, would back off a bit. And it was, almost 2 weeks from now, it'd be a year over at my website, Brian McGrath wrote an article that I thought kind of wrapped up a lot of different lines through the years where, you know, one thing he called for was boldness. And when you look at the mission statement at the Center for Maritime Strategy, it mentions the advocacy effort and enhancing understanding. And one thing the Mitchell Center is fairly good at is in General Datula, especially a couple times, I've heard people accuse him of being a troll. I don't think he's being a troll. He just, on occasion, he finds that real thin line between making a firm point and stepping on somebody's toes. It seems to be putting a shadow on an area that he wants to advocate for. And I think that's part of the gap in that ecosystem that the Center for Maritime Strategy really has an opportunity here is there's a way to have a polite conversation where you don't think that's an obligation to back down and surrender the argument, so to speak. Do you see that is going to be a part of what we can look for the center is something that kind of like what the Mitchell Institute does, which I think a polite way of talking it could be a firm advocacy with some politely placed elbows when on occasion to emphasize a point that otherwise might be missed in a more polite conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I go back to my earlier days in one of my assignments at OSD, working for just an incredible man, another gentleman that we lost a few years ago, Dr. Paris Janalis, who's director of Naval War, what was USD A&T at the time. And we did a lot of thinking. We did a lot of talking. We did a lot of association with think tanks. I just wrote in the last Sea Power blog that I did about a week ago on the Defense Science Board Task Force on Submarines. And, you know, this was to look forward past the Virginia class 20 years hence. So that report came out in 1998. And it was all about the next generation submarine. But in order to get there, the DSD did a future study, kind of a mini future study. And I went back and looked at these slides. They're on Class Online, released by DTIC back in 1998. And their assessment of a strategic competitor for the U.S. in 2020, right now, essentially, was there will be no competitor. And in 2050, it was one of two, either Russia or China. So, you know, we got that dead wrong. But Dr. Janalis loved doing stuff like this. He made me the government advisor for that DSD task force. He did a number of other things up at MIT, and that's my point, because he was a PhD from the University of Michigan, I think. He's a Fulbright scholar, came from Greece. He was on a scholarship with Admiral Rickover at one period of time, and he ultimately designed a propulsion train for USS Seawolf. I remember taking him out on the boat with, you know, then Commander Mike Connor, who retired as Comsubland, Vice Admiral Mike Connor. And, you know, all Paris wanted to do was go back aft in his suit and tie and crawl underneath the shaft and look at the propulsion train, because he hadn't seen it in operation before. That was pretty cool. But, one of the things we did when we were up at MIT was to look at, you know, what do we do with the Tridents as they come up on decommissioning? And there was a movement afoot with Paris and Linton Brooks, Captain Brooks over the National Security Council to, you know, convert them to SSGNs. And that study from MIT led to a lot of crosstalk here in Washington. We ultimately did that. And thank God we did that, because, you know, I was the J3 for Joint Task Force Odyssey Dawn in 2011. And USS Florida, one of those SSGNs, been at sea for like 18 months. She was headed home. And she ended up shooting about 110 Tomahawks in that campaign against Qaddafi's forces. And so it was a, you know, virtual floating, you know, I hesitate to use the word arsenal ship, but, you know, that program didn't go so well, but just phenomenal. We're coming up on the end of service life. We've extended those for a very long time. Well, while we're up at MIT, we met, you know, Harvey Sapolsky, been around for a long time, post-war director of strategic studies at MIT, and he turned over later to Dr. Owen Cote. Owen was one of the most brilliant geopolitical strategists I've ever met. He's read every book in Widener Library, got his PhD up at Harvard, and it was the application of Goldwater Nichols. And part of Owen's thesis was that, you know, jointness, you got to have it after the failed mission Desert One in 1979 against the Iranians, and we've come a long way. There's a lot of goodness in Goldwater Nichols, but there's also goodness in a fair fight for resources amongst the services. And that brings me back to the one-third, one-third, one-third paradigm. And I think it's time for, you know, the Navy and the maritime services to advocate for more, because we're doing a lot of the heavy lifting. You know, you guys probably like him as much as I do, the author Robert Kaplan. I quote him all the time from Asia's Cauldron. You know, this is not just the naval decade, it's a naval century. And, you know, we've got to be out there and operating in what he calls the stopping power of water. And that's why we need big capital ships like aircraft carriers and submarines and cruisers and destroyers and frigates, you know, to make their way across this vast expanse of ocean and tyranny of distance, particularly in the Western Pacific, to defend not only our interests, you know, on the pointy end of the spear, but also those of our allies and partners. So, you know, when, Sal, when you say enhancing understanding, that's what we want to try to do. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I'm tired of picking up the newspaper and seeing yet another article, you know, bashing the United States Navy. And if you take, you know, carriers for an example, I'm a submariner, but I'm a big proponent of carriers. I mean, Harry S. Truman was the mainstay of Exercise Trident Juncture, arguably the largest and, you know, I dare say the most successful NATO exercise since the end of the Cold War. We hadn't had a carrier up in the high north for over 20 years. And I got the idea from one of the former Secretary of the Navy's, John Layman, when I read his book, Ocean's Venture. And when he talked about the implementation of the maritime strategy of 1986 and going up over the top of the COLA and taking the fight to the enemy, I was like, hey, I'm all about that. So we went back to General Mattis, and we submitted a paper on dynamic forward presence and asked for the carrier, and he gave it to us. I mean, yeah, my staff did all the work. It went up through UCOM to the Joint Staff to OSD, and General Mattis was all about demonstrating that capability of dynamic forward presence. You know, not one young person. I was talking to Admiral John Richardson about this the other day. John is an international vice president of the Navy League. He's got an office that periodically comes in and occupies at Navy League headquarters. And, you know, we were talking about the value of Harry S. Truman and the fact that, you know, we deployed her in the high north in the winter months of October and November of 2018. It's the coldest time of the year. And people ask me, why do you do that? Why'd you do that? That was the hardest time. I mean, it was 12 to 18 foot seas. And I said, because you got to train like you fight. And just like the Florida coming home from 18 months at sea, you know, stopped, turned around, went to its launch box and did yeoman service in Joint Task Force Odyssey Dawn in Libya, so did Harry S. Truman. You know, the one-star strike group commander at the time was Admiral Gene Black. And it's no surprise and no coincidence that he's now the 6th Fleet commander. You know, as far as I was concerned, stellar performance as a strike group commander. But neither he nor any of the other young people on board that ship had operated up there. And they were pumping out F-18s in that exercise. I mean, there was a huge air war going on associated with Trident Juncture, which was an Article 5 operation to get the Russians out of Norway. We had 50,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, you know, in the skies, on the sea, on the land, doing amphibious operations. I mean, it was absolutely outstanding. And we couldn't have done it without that carrier. And so today, when I read about, you know, well, the USS Ford costs a lot of money, $13.5. You know, we've been going through some growing pains here. We need to get her out to sea and get her deployed. Well, absolutely, we got to get her out to sea and get her deployed. There's a plan to do that the end of 22 and 2023. And I think it's going to be a phenomenal platform. You know, I mentioned to you, I worked for Admiral Bowman over at Naval Reactors. And while I was there, the design phase for this was 2001 to 2003. The design phase with Ford was being debated, and there were several very bright engineers that were helping Admiral Bowman with his piece of that ship. One incredibly bright and articulate and well-educated woman named Karen Hennenberger, and she was working with PEO carriers to put the United States of America's best foot forward. So there are a whole bunch of things about that carrier that are new and different, you know, and kind of disruptive technologies. It's got a different kind of conning tower sail area. It's in a different location. It's got a bigger flight deck. It's got a huge hangar bay. It can carry more strike fighters. It has a phenomenal propulsion system that won't have to be refueled as much. And probably the biggest headache is the electromagnetic assisted launch catapults. You know, they're not steam catapults, and most of your listeners know that, you know, it's electronic, so you save a lot in terms of you know, maintenance on the ship, and you generate electromagnetic energy that causes this thing to go down and, you know, launch a high performance aircraft off the deck just like you would with steam. And the elevators are also electromagnetic assisted elevators, and they've had some problems with those. They're working. This is the first ship of the class. So they're working through all of these different things. Some people say, well, we shouldn't have put, you know, so many new types of things on one platform. Well, you know what? You got to take some risk. And sometimes you're going to meet with, but you get up and, you know, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you keep moving forward. And that's what we've done with the Ford. And, oh, by the way, I think the second, third, and fourth ship of the class, we've got you know, Dory Miller, we've got John F. Kennedy, and we've got Enterprise coming. And they are going to be phenomenal ships in the inventory of the United States Navy. And if there was no need for carriers, then I don't know why the Chinese want, you know, 12 of their own. And certainly we have the most advanced capability and the advanced technology and the best sailors in the world to sail those things. I mean, my former aide from Sixth Fleet went out to be the shooter on board USS Ford, and I asked him about EMALS, and at the time he said, yeah, it works great. You know, this guy is a naval aviator. He should know. And so, you know, the last thing I'll tell you about this phenomenal capability, and it gets to the crux of your question, is there any, you know, going to be any elbowing out there? Well, you know, it may be cliche-esque, guys, but, you know, for four decades in the United States Navy, I used to hear this phrase all the time, and I think it was one of Ronald Reagan's favorites. When there was a crisis someplace in the world, the president wakes up and he says, where are my carriers? You know, he doesn't say, where are my B-2 bombers? We know where they are. You know, they're in the continental United States. But those carriers are forward deployed someplace, and they give the president options, and they give National Command Authority decision space, because we're already there. And so, there is a certain value in that that no other service can deliver. You know, 90,000 tons of sovereign American territory out there in the middle of the Western Pacific or in the Eastern Mediterranean or any place else, the Middle East, the Arabian Gulf, any place else that we operate forward in harm's way. Yeah, I'm all about that. And this, you know, this doesn't have to get, into a knife fight, but I think that we've got to advocate for what we believe in. And I firmly believe in, you know, the naval air arm and power projection from the sea. Back to you.
Well, that's one of the issues that we've discussed here many times is fighting sea blindness, as one first sea lord put it for the Brits. Is this new program, the Center for Maritime Strategy, designed or do you foresee it as helping to fight the battle against sea blindness? Because people have taken so much for granted. The Navy's always been there. It's always said can do. Our merchant marine has shrunk considerably because we've been able to use foreign ships to bring our goods and stuff. So I'm not sure people have been paying as much attention they should. Is part of your mission set as you see it to change that and to open up the eyes of people so they're not sea blind?
Yep, absolutely. And, let me just say a couple of things about sea blindness and, you know, the incredible capability that we have in our navies and our associated maritime brothers and sisters that are really important, and they can't be lost on the American people. I think I mentioned earlier Samuel Huntington, his great, 1954 essay in Proceedings on, why a transoceanic Navy and what I take away from that. I have a little different interpretation than, the Honorable Mr. Bob Work, who I absolutely love. He just put out a paper on foreign presence that talked about the Navy's slavish devotion to foreign presence. I have a different take on that. And he also talked about Huntington. I have a different take on Huntington. I think Huntington's strategic concept, at least for me, in being involved in a couple of different maritime strategies, CS-21, and by the way, Brian McGrath was the head of that team when I got to the Pentagon, and I recognized, how talented that officer was, and I'm so pleased to see Brian continuing to advocate through his group, Ferry Bridge, out here in the Washington, D.C. area and inside the Beltway with all of the think tanks. And he's been a very busy guy, too. And we both, we talk the same lines of effort in support of the maritime. But, Huntington's strategic concept was all about the demonstration of naval force capabilities for a number of different entities, for the American people. Who are taxpayers for our representatives on Capitol Hill, for our national command authority, for the President of the United States, and for our allies and partners. And if you can't demonstrate why you're going to spend billions of dollars on these platforms and our most precious commodity, our people. You know, you have hardware ships at sea and software, you have people and sailing ships. You should go home and or go back to the drawing board and figure something else out. So here's what I say about a strategic concept. You know, the Navy is uniquely positioned to manage all these complex security challenges that, you know, I just talked to you guys about, the five adversaries or enemies of the United States in the national defense strategy. And we've demonstrated that we have unrestricted global mobility based on free use of international ocean space. I mean, they call it the global commons, but you know what? It's getting tougher and tougher to operate in these commons because we used to operate, you know, during my day in the Third Battle of the Atlantic with impunity. We could go anywhere and operate anywhere. Yeah, you know, the battle off the Gulf of Sidra in Libya in 2011 was virtually unopposed. Let's call it not a hostile environment, but kind of borderline permissive, non-permissive environment. There was a lot of stuff on the ground that was shooting at us as we were flying strike fighters over top and putting ships along the coast to interdict, you know, some of Gaddafi's 32nd Brigade. But it was nothing like the kind of fight that you would experience today in the first or second island chain, or potentially in a place like the Black Sea, which is heating up right now. So we've had the ability to project that power, and it's gotten tougher and tougher, and we've adapted to that over time. You know, the use of the seas as a global maritime maneuver space is important, and so is forward presence. It gives us, you know, kind of an interesting heads up on the lay of the land through intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. As I said, you know, you have those carrier strike groups operating out there forward, and it gives National Command Authority and the President of the United States an idea of what's going on. You know, you don't put carriers in the Black Sea, but for the last month, we've had USS Mount Whitney, USS Porter, USS Arleigh Burke in the Black Sea, and we've been gleaning a lot from those magnificent ships, two of which are Aegis platforms, because they see everything that's going on. And I think that's helped the National Command Authority make a determination on the likelihood or non-likelihood of President Putin and Russian forces doing something on the border of Donbass in the Ukraine. You know, all this while, you know, we've had an incredible deterrent against conventional and hybrid threats. So we've got a national deterrent in the form of you know, our portion of the triad, arguably the most secure. And I'd argue with anybody all day long. I served on an SSBN. I was an operations officer on an SSBN. It is the most secure portion of the triad, and Colombia will be, again, the most secure portion of the triad. From what I know of it, it's going to be a magnificent ship. It's going to cost us some money. And, you know, I think the American people and, you know, all the different cabinets of government should wake up and assist the Navy with part of that bill. This is a national deterrent, not a Navy deterrent. It's for protection of the homeland. And they're going to be expensive ships, and we need them. And they're going to have to last for over 50 years as we go forward into the 21st century against all these threats. You know, we demonstrate a full range of military operations from non-combatant evacuation operations. I mean, every time there's a humanitarian disaster of epic proportions, you know, you look at some of the, you know, the tsunamis out in the Western Pacific, and it's usually U.S. naval forces that are first on site with amphibious ships and rotary wing aircraft to provide assistance. And we do that because Americans tend to be philanthropic, and they want to do that. They want to help. It's a lesser and included portion of what we do, but it's a capability that we have, and we need to use it when our friends and partners are in trouble. That creates big dividends for us later on. So it's all part of this concept that you get back because, you know, someday you might need those friends and allies to support you when we're trying to do something that's controversial or doesn't necessarily garner, you know, huge proponent of global positivism, when the United States has to stand up and use its big stick to enforce the rules out there on the high seas. The last thing I'll tell you is, we generate tremendous asymmetric military advantages. We have the best technology in the world. I've said before, we have the best people in the world. And we're building more on that technology as we experiment with unmanned systems in the undersea and on top of the seas and in the air. And I'm really excited about new initiatives like Joint All-Domain Command and Control and Project Overmatch. I'm heading out to San Diego tomorrow, to be with Admiral Courtney and Admiral Swift to assist Admiral Small with a symposium on Overmatch, and I'm really excited about that. So that's the strategic concept that, the Navy and the maritime services bring to the table. Now, how do you get people to pay attention to that? Well, for the center, folks have asked me, well, how do you intend to run this show, and where are you in this chronology or timeline of, the unveiling of the Center for Maritime Strategy? And I'll take you back to, one of those great mentors I had, both on the Navy staff, and then he took me down the hall to the Joint Staff to be his first EA for 2 years as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and that's Admiral Mike Mullen, and arguably one of the best chairmen we ever had. And the guy that relieved me as the EA for the next 2 years and his last 2 years for a total of 4 years was, Captain Mike Gilday, who's now, of course, our CNO. And Admiral Mullen said, hey, whenever you get to a new job, you need to do the following things. And this served him well. And, he would tell me this in conversations because, he expected me to continue on in the service and to learn from my exposure to him. He said, you've got to first listen and learn, then educate and lead. I never forgot that. In fact, I used that in every command that I went to after, I guess I was on my second or third command when I went to work for them, so I had, six or seven more to go. And so part of what we want to do is I'm in the listen and learn mode right now. And as I get more staff and people, and I'll tell you a little bit about, how I intend to build staff here, because, resources only go so far. You can only bring somebody on the team, but there's force multipliers, and we're in a perfect location inside the Beltway, absolutely perfect to be able to do this. But we need to advance understanding of the contributions of all the maritime services and that strategic concept of Huntington and how it contributes to American security and prosperity through the provision of resources and take our staff and be able to write and advocate. I want my own podcast. We want to try to do some webinars. We're going to try to build a studio in the center. And so I'd love to have you guys on that podcast if we can get that up and running in 2022. You up for it?
Yeah, we're always up for chatting. Part of that building that multi, what do all the cool kids call it? The multi-channel access to the information space. I think that's a great idea, and I think it gives you some opportunities to, have a shorter cycle time for communications. I was thinking when you mentioned Bob Work's article earlier. Matter of fact, last week we had old Captain Barney Rubel on the podcast talking about his article.
Barney. Yeah, great guy. Yeah.
Yeah, it was on the same issue, and I as well. Bob Work had been on the podcast a few years ago as well. Another alumni. I have a few issues with his article because, the title itself, the slavish devotion to presence. I don't know. That's kind of like somebody tell me my slavish devotion to my wife. I'm sorry. That's kind of a critical mission of mine. I don't think I could be too slavishly devoted to that. But he mentioned something in that article that tied in to something that's come up a few times. And, back when you didn't have any, you barely had any scuff marks on your lieutenant bars, and I was still a second-class midshipman, 1986, Goldwater Nichols came along. And of your, 40 years
on active duty. 35 of it were under Goldwater Nichols. And for me, that's all I knew, was that reality. And, you know, here we are 40 years later. And that one little quote in Bob Work's article, was it was specifically about one of the parallel changes that came with Goldwater Nichols, in addition to the almost verbal tick about jointness that can sometimes get in the way of having interesting conversations. But the quote is, quote, "And that helps explain why the incessant demands for naval forces from regional COCOMs are seldom challenged and much less denied," unquote. And that's one thing that we talked about with Barney about last week as well, is Goldwater Nichols and how the COCOMs are run now and all the various habits and accretions that have taken place since 1986, that the chief of naval operations is in many regards, in some ways by statute, he's sidelined from the conversation about how to properly husband, if that's not the right word, perhaps having proper stewardship of our naval forces with a longer-term view. So it's almost like we have a short fight here, replying to people like Bob Work's article and some of his heresies that need to be addressed, but also a deeper fight. And I wanted, because I know you've had some great things to say about Goldwater Nichols, and it did address the concerns, a half decade, little plus a couple of years that gave birth to it. But, you know, here we are, coming up on 2022, and there's obviously issues with Goldwater Nichols. The world's extremely different than it was in 1986. And there are some inefficiencies as a COCOM, and obviously, you know, there are also advantages if you are a COCOM too. So how do you see the role of the center, and maybe some of the specifics about that, these multi-channels to addressing the near fight for people who bring up ideas that are worthy of discussion in the short term, but also longer term issues like the COCOM structures and Goldwater Nichols that have a very serious impact on the Chief of Naval Operations and the Navy itself, doing what centuries have told people who run navies you need to do to be able to sustain and properly take one over decades, vice over palm cycles?
Hey, phenomenal question. And, we may, is it okay if we run over our hour?
Absolutely.
So let me give you my take on this, because you mentioned a number of different people, a number of different authors, and, you know, Barney, God bless him, was up in the Naval War College when I was working strategy in N35, helped me out considerably. And, he was just a national treasure. And so is, you know, the Honorable Mr. Bob Work, who was, you know, one of our best undersecretaries in the Navy and Deputy Secretary of Defense, I think, from 2014 to 2017. Now, what Mr. Work talks about in his essay, I've read the essay and also listened to the podcast he did with Bill Hamblett, another good friend, is, the slavish devotion to presence has degraded our capability to keep our ships at sea and has worn our, you know, the hardware, and it's worn down our software, our people, with some of these double pump deployments that we've been doing. And that, presence should not be a mission of the United States Navy. War fighting should be a mission. Well, okay, I agree to disagree. And I'll tell you, what we need is not presence for presence sake. You know, when I was part of a big part as N35B, that strategy, CS21R in 2015, what we needed then and still need today and advocated for was presence with a purpose. So there's got to be some limitations put on there. Now, Mr. Work talks about the submarine force and how the submarine force manages this. Not to tout any one service, but there's, you know, X number of SSNs available for deployment out there. And when you run out, you don't get any more. And when there are requirements to do maintenance, particularly in the nuclear end of the business, there are no exceptions to that. The ship comes home. And so we've managed that very well over time. Now, if you conduct presence with a purpose and you do forward presence smartly, you can have both. And I'll give you an example that I helped stand up from 2014 through the end of my career in 2020, and that was four deployed naval forces in Rota, Spain. There were two destroyers there when I got there, 6th Fleet. We added two more. Then we wrote the book on the FRTP, the Fleet Response Training Plan, for those four destroyers. You know, there would be two out at any one time, one in training, one in maintenance. 50% op tempo, 50% burst tempo. We had an excellent base in Rota. We had infrastructure and facilities, schools, housing, hospital, even a hospital. And, you know, and some of you guys have been there. And we had a great yard that was supporting us that was not a U.S. yard. Now, it had U.S. people and engineers and technicians and civil servants that we hired, but the labor was done by Navantia in Spain, and they kept those ships in tip-top condition. I would dare say that we sent the first one home, Carney, probably in as good or better condition than she went over, and that is not the case with some of the ships that are coming back from FDNF Japan. And so it was a model, and the reason why it worked well was because, you know, we didn't allow any waivers, and I think one time we broke op tempo. It was brought to my attention when I was 6th Fleet commander by Admiral Mark Ferguson. And he said, hey, I was down the waterfront talking to COs, and they said that their op tempo is approaching or exceeding 60%. I said, sir, that's impossible. We have DERS reporting. No way. I'm getting different reports. So I went and dug in and found out that, yes, he was absolutely right, and those COs were right. We were taking guys out of the maintenance phase or training phase and sending them up to do stuff like flag officer sea training in the Hebrides because it was great training, but it was busting the op tempo limits because then they go and deploy for 4 months after that. So we stopped that practice. And the other thing that was wrong was we didn't have a Commodore in co-location with those ships. So, you know, I rapid deployed the next Commodore coming in, first he fleet up as a deputy and then as Commodore, and it was Joe Gagliano, and I called up CNP and said, send him to Rota, and if he's the only guy standing on the pier, we'll figure out how to get the rest of the staff out there, and we did that, and it's working swimmingly well. And, you know, one of those Commodores went out after the two collisions at PAC Fleet, Rich Drummerhauser, and helped him stand up the SWDIC task force to assist on that using some of the lessons learned that we had. I remember Admiral Richardson came over and he looked at the program and he said, hey, this is running pretty well. What's the secret sauce? I said, the people are. And the squadron staff and in particular the Commodores, you know, guys like Drummerhauser, Tate Westbrook, John Espinosa, who just did a marvelous job and managed that extremely well. So if managed properly and you conduct presence with a purpose, not presence for presence's sake, you can do this. I mean, those ships are multifunction, multi-mission ships. They're all over the high north, the North Atlantic, the Baltic. We do Baltops every year. We're in the eastern Mediterranean where it's dicey and hot now that the Russians have a significant presence there. We go into the Black Sea. We deploy in the Black Sea. And like I said, you know, the three platforms that have been there in the last month have brought back a treasure trove of information and value added for U.S. intelligence and for National Command Authority on what's going on. So you can do this, and you can do it right. Where we have fallen short is exactly what you were talking about, Sal, and that is we have a problem with Goldwater Nichols in the way that the COCOMs report. They go directly to SecDef, and so there's a high demand signal. And I understand that. They have all sorts of issues they have to deal with, and they don't have enough resources. And so these requests for forces come in, and they go to a global force management board. I've sat on those boards as N35B, which was a phenomenal job that gave me exposure to a lot of things. I've been into the ops depths tank. You know, when Admiral Greenard, who was my boss, couldn't go, he would send a qualified officer to the tank to sit in with the director of the joint staff and try to resolve some of these issues so they didn't have to come to the attention of the service chiefs. A lot of these issues, and General Goldfein was the director at the time, he did a wonderful job of managing them. We're okay, you know, so-and-so in a COCOM needs a ship, a carrier strike group, a submarine, and or a capability or people. And so this RFF is not going to go away. You know, which one of you guys from the services or gals is going to support this? And you know, I can tell you many times, my vote was we can't support it, and the response was force to source. That's what Work's talking about in his article. Now, he was a Deputy Secretary of Defense. He also says either on the podcast or in the article that he was out of that chain. And a lot of the Force to Source comes from the SecDef Orders book, which is the input comes from the services. It goes to the Joint Staff to the J3. The book is prepared, and a special briefer, Mike Franken, used to do it the day when Donald Rumsfeld was up there, and he was one tough customer. You sit down with the secretary, and you go down the list of forces that need to deploy and support these RFFs. And a lot of times in the book it says, you know, the service, cannot support, and it comes back as a force to source. So therein lies the problem. There's got to be appetite suppression somewhere in the system. Now, I told you, I was up at Georgetown University for a sabbatical when I was, in town, Washington, not in the Pentagon or not over at NR. And I had the great experience and pleasure of being Jesuit trained. And there was a professor who had been a naval officer as a young man named Father Jim Shaw. And I took his class, which was, on philosophy, the Peloponnesian Wars. And that guy taught me things and made me read books that I had not read at the Naval Academy. And one of my favorite quotes from Father Shaw was, when you read Aristotle, the bridge between the books, Nicomachean Ethics and the Politics, these are separate books that talk about ethics and politics, is the phrase, and I quote, "Government begins when fathers can no longer control their sons." So think about that in the context of what I just said. The appetite suppression has to come from the Secretary of Defense. So, yes, the Navy steps forward and will say, look, I've got plans for this platform to go in a shipyard and conduct a scheduled availability. And, when those plans go awry, when the secretary says, I'm sorry, we have a legitimate need out in the COCOM, and you're just going to have to send that ship back into theater, a la one of these double pumps on our carriers. Not only does it put the wear and tear on the hardware and software, but it also screws up your shipyard loading curve, which we have seen in spades recently. And so that appetite suppression, that's why I think in Mr. Work's article, the slavish devotion to presence is a misnomer. I think the problem lies in the way we have set up this requirements process in the office of the Secretary of Defense. That's got to get fixed. And when it gets fixed, we'll stop seeing these problems. But until then, everybody has a boss. We are subordinate to civilian authority. And so when your big boss tells you, yeah, I hear what you say, it's going to be painful, but you got to do it anyway, then we're a can-do service. We go and do that. And the only way around it is going to be that appetite suppression. So back to you guys.
Yeah, I hate to keep you any longer, Admiral, unless you got a couple of minutes. But one of the questions that was asked in our board is how do you plan to sell the idea of greater support for our maritime infrastructure, which I think you just talked about a Spanish shipyard doing great work on ships that better than the ones that were arriving from the States, I guess. Fairly fresh out of the U.S. yards. How do we sell that we need more and faster expansion of our industrial base in the maritime community?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't have enough dry docks. You can go back to the Belisle report. About a year ago, I did a short study just to, self-inform on where we are and where we have been. And, Admiral Belisle, who was around at NAVC when I was working for Admiral Bowman, came up with this incredibly incisive report on how we have sacrificed maintenance and readiness for, op tempo. And it gets back to what I was just talking about, and certainly what Mr. Work says in his essay. So all of that is true. It's the mechanism or the politics of how you get there. It's the problem with forward presence and presence for presence sake is not a Navy problem, although the burden of responsibility comes back to the Navy. It's a political problem. And so what can you do about that? You can advocate for more in terms of shipyards and industrial base. you know, more investment in docks. You know, we've got this, you know, $1 trillion infrastructure plan. You know, some of that money should be going into our ability to bend metal and put ships to sea. We don't have enough merchant ships. The Navy League is working on advocacy for the Jones Act and getting, you know, more merchant mariners out there on ships that are U.S. flagged and that are dual use, so commercial ships that could be used, you know, for military applications. We talked about this at the Admiral of the Ocean Seas Award. Admiral Wetlaufer gave a great speech about, you know, consul ships for a couple $100,000. You can take one of these merchant marine ships and turn it into a refueler, and we don't have enough of those, and we need more. But, you know, this gets back to the industrial base, and there's something out there called the PSYOP. And why they picked that term, you know, PSYOP means something different to me, but it's the shipyard integrated optimization plan. It's like $25 billion over a 20-year period to pump that money into the industrial base for maritime shipbuilding. You know, I think I said something in a blog or on a podcast recently that was 20 years is too far out. You know, we need to make that injection of capital in 10 years, and we need to step it up. We need, you know, more shipyard workers, abilities, more places to go. And if you start, you know, putting investments, if the government is serious about an investment in our marine industrial base, it's like Kevin Costner's Field of Dreams, right? If you build it, they will come. You'll see industry coming forward and responding to that demand signal, particularly because it could be, you know, monetarily beneficial to them to make that investment. And then once that investment is made, we can start bending metal and putting more ships out, or, as importantly, doing the readiness and modernization of the existing fleet, which is going to be around for a while. You know, the ships, the 300, 305 ships that we have today are still going to be here in 2030 fighting a good fight, whether that's in the Western Pacific, depending on what happens out there, or any place else in the world that's a hot spot, Europe or the Middle East. And so, yeah, I'm all about that. And so, you know, you're going to see some work inside the center on advocacy for not just the services, but also industry and our shipbuilding capability. I think, you know, when you look at our merchant marine, somebody was quoting me the other day that the United States is around number 17 in the world U.S. flag vessels that, you know, operate in commerce on the high seas. I think Italy is number 16. Love the Italians. You know, they're building our frigate. China's number one. That's unacceptable. That's unacceptable. You know, we should have much more in terms of U.S. flagged and operating, not just, you know, per the Jones Act and the intercoastal waterways of the United States, but also globally out there about on the pointy end of the spear. And in some cases, that dual use and consul technology supporting not just the merchant marine, but also our military ships that are out there doing God's work all over the world in presence operations to deter and defend, you know, when our nation says we need to do so. Hopefully that answers your question. And I'll tell you, like I said, I'm hiring, but there's a limit to how many people I can bring on board. So I'm going to try to establish a tiered system of fellows. I work in work in a number of think tanks around town. Center for European Policy Analysis is one of them. There are fellows, there are senior fellows, there are distinguished fellows, graduated level of fellowship according to one's experience. And that's a force multiplier for any think tank. So I'm going to do the same. I'm looking at some kind of an advisory board, an internship program of young, hungry people, you know, like Midshipman Sal back in the Naval Academy in 1986 or Eagle One. And, or me, you know, back when I was at the Naval Academy, who want to come in and do some work. And then there's the 1099 crowd where I can go out and I can have somebody do some work for us and be properly compensated for that work. But, you know, we'll pick the topics and they'll help us with the analytics and the writing. Over.
Well, that's going to make 22 a
an adventurous year for you as you get a chance. Like I think you said at the start of the show, you've been at this a couple, 3 weeks. And I assume for the listener, the best place they can go is, I know there's a placeholder there at the main website for the Naval League of the United States. If people want to keep track as you get your team built and y'all start to get some product and some channels open, would that be the best place they could go, or you have some other ideas where the listeners could go to keep tracks as things develop?
2 to 3 week period, we have stood up our website, and it's tagged to the Navy League website, so it's the Center for Maritime Strategy. It's got some of the papers, some of the links to the blogs and the podcast that I've done and some other associated work that's out there that's of interest to the center. It's got a cool moving video on the top with, you know, one of our aircraft carriers underway and going to sea and doing God's work for the United States of America. And you can take a look at that. You can also send us an email. And I'm at jfogo@navyleague.org. Pretty easy to remember that one, all lowercase. And for your listeners and for both of you guys, you know, we're happy for any advocate of maritime power in the United States of America or overseas to become a member of the Navy League. And that can be as inexpensive as an e-membership for $25 a year. You know, so you take your buddies out for a beer and a bar, that's $25. So I'm not advocating for you not getting a beer and a bar, but just think about it in the context of that's a small amount of money, and you get access to everything that we're doing and the online edition of Sea Power magazine. And the next thing for me, you know, another force multiplier is that Navy League has its own building. It has its own infrastructure. It has its own marketing director. It has its own legislative affairs branch. There's all sorts of platforms for me to participate, like Sea Power magazine, and I've taken advantage of that a couple times already, you know, to put out a biweekly blog on things that I believe in and the direction that we want to go in. And so it's already there. It's already stood up, and I'm going to make full use of that. We're going to have the next Sea Air and Space in April, I think it's April 3rd to 5th of 2022. The last one was in August. We hadn't done it. We missed a year because of COVID. And I don't know if you guys know the stats, but that was the most successful Sea Air and Space symposium in the history of the Navy League. We had 17,000 participants come to National Harbor to be a part of that. 171 plus, you know, speakers. And I did a working breakfast and a moderated panel with some of our foreign counterparts, Second Sea Lord, Canadian CNO, former CNO, and current CNO of the German Navy, and a representative from the aerospace industry. So what an incredible opportunity, you know, to get the word out. And we're planning on doing a Center for Maritime Strategy breakfast at the symposium in April. Topics and speakers yet to be determined, but I'm working on it. I'd like some folks from the Hill to come in and animate the debate, and I'd like some strategists to come in and animate the debate. I got a whole list of people who are possible. And we, you know, we have an annual convention. There's 170 plus councils for the Navy League all over the continental United States and Europe, 30,000 members. They have a voice. They also have, they also live in congressional districts, and they have representatives and they're taxpayers and they vote. And so they get to vote for us too. And so we have a grassroots campaign where, you know, through our national president, Dave Riley, we can go out and leverage, you know, that powerful lobby of the Navy League. Dave has been in-house here last week. He's really supportive of the Center for Maritime Strategy. And he said, hey, I'd like to get together with you at a concentration of councils, you know, say in a fleet concentration area like San Diego, where we bring in a number of different Navy League councils and, you know, have a working seminar on what you're doing and how we can help. And I'm all in. I'm ready to go. And I look forward to the challenges in 2022 and hopefully talking to you guys again. And I really appreciate your support for the center and for the Navy League and for your listeners. Don't forget www.navyleague.org. Get online and become members, and you'll be a de facto supporter of the Center for Maritime Strategy, and I really appreciate anything you can do to help us.
Well, we really appreciate you spending time with us today and giving us extra time than the hour we negotiated for. Really appreciate it, and we got a lot of information here for the listeners. And do look forward to an opportunity to talk to you again in the future, and I hope you and yours have a great holiday season and a productive new year.
Hey, Sal, Eagle One, happy holidays to all of you and all your listeners. Thanks very much for the opportunity to participate. I look forward to doing this again.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Yeah.